gruesome items. While Stanton watched, the golem reached out one brass hand, clad in a blood-crusted fingerless woolen glove, and carefully turned the head of the aviapt so that it faced Starlek's head. It then looked up and gazed at Stanton with midnight eyes.
"Found it."
Semper came over and handed a small console to Angelina. The woman's hand was shaking, Stanton noted, as she took the console and detached from it the small black pebble of a control module. She closed her eyes for a second, concentrating, then slipped the module into one of her belt pouches. "Stand up, Mr. Crane," she said finally. The golem stood and stepped aside, as if ready to come around the table. Stanton took a step back. Jesus, the thing was big. Standing there, it seemed to fill the entire room. Stanton estimated it to be at least 2.5 meters tall.
"Hold it there!"
Angelina yelled. The golem froze. "You will follow us, doing no more than I instruct," she said, with enforced calm in her voice. She turned to Stanton. "Put that mine of yours on its chest, over its brain case." Stanton was not so sure he wanted to get that close, but he obeyed. As he stepped in, the golem abruptly reached up and undid the top buttons on its coat, exposing its brassy chest. Stanton placed the mine carefully, hoping that hand movement had been at Angelina's behest. The golem buttoned up its coat again.
"Okay, let's go," she said.
The golem reached down and closed its hand over one of the severed heads.
"Leave that!"
The hand closed, and the head imploded with a dull thud, spewing bloody gobbets of brain across the tabletop.
"Follow!"
As Angelina turned away, Stanton saw the golem's hand snap out and take up the small rubber dog, which it slipped quickly into its pocket. He made no comment on this, nor when the golem turned its face towards him and half closed one eye in what might have been a wink. With Semper at his side, he just followed the killing machine out, glad that the thing was walking at Angelina's back rather than his own. Retroact ends.
"A message in a bottle would be the nearest analogy."
Cormac chewed over the words as they crossed the now empty chamber to the flint runcible. Before reaching the dais, he halted and glanced round at his companions. Gant stood beside Mika, as if ready to prevent her escape. Perhaps that was because it had taken so long to get her moving. The result of this delay was now stacked on a grav sled that Thorn guided by a remote control device, the woman's luggage. The Flint AI had already emptied the place, and Cormac knew that it was training just about every detector available on his companions. It had shut down all computer access other than the voice link to itself, and there were no robots present, nothing that Jane technology could subvert. "But there's no record of the Vulture having landed there," he suggested.
"No record of that ship's presence, true," replied the Flint AI. "But 3 ships did land that could easily have been the Vulture. Also, Viridian did detect a U-Space signature unrelated to any ships that landed in the designated areas. The most likely explanation is that Skellor has installed chameleonware on the Vulture and brought it down somewhere else."
"And the essence of the message?"
Vulture is managing to retain some independence by shifting herself into a memory sector not occupied by a Jane thrall program. Each time she does this and initiates some independent action, the program occupies that sector, forcing Vulture to move on. Obviously, there is a limit to how many times she can do this. She also detailed the events on the asteroid, which we had already surmised. Is there anything to suggest where Skellar is going? All she knew was that he went to Viridian to obtain a pathetic metal skin to complete. These are Vulture's words, though I gather the information was obtained by translating Jane code, bleeding directly from Skellor's non-verbal thought processes. Cormac was surprised. He had expected the pursuit to be a ship-borne one rather than one through the Polity Runcible network, because if it was true that Skellor was after the dragon spheres, he'd more likely find them on the Polity border or beyond.
"You can get hold of metal skins anywhere in the Polity," said Gant.
"Viridian seems an unlikely place to go looking for one," Thorn added. Cormac looked at Mika, waiting for her opinion. She appeared ill to him, but perhaps that was imagination after all that she had told him. In measured tones, she said, "Viridian is where we encountered the Maker. It is also where you killed Arion Pelter. There was a metal skin golem there with Pelter, that brass killer of his called Mr. Crane."
"That's true," said Thorn, "but Cento and Aiden seriously fucked up that one."
Cormac glanced at him. "You're right. They tore it apart and then shattered its mind. There should be nothing there for Skellar. However," he turned and looked towards the Runcible. "Flint, I need you to reset to Viridian. I have to go there to find out what this is all about."
"Unfortunately, I cannot do this until after your companions have departed. They must go to Elysium, where precautions have been taken, and then on to the Jack Ketch."
It made sense. Mika or Thorn could rush at the interface once it was reset and end up on a world where no precautions had yet been made against Jane Tech subversion. Earth Central was now taking precautions over anyone who had merely come in contact with that tech. But those two, who definitely carried it inside them, the AI was treating like possible plague carriers. "Okay," Cormac turned to his companions. "Mika, once you're on the Jack Ketch, get aboard what you require. It can be sent by robotic craft from the Jerusalem. Make sure you get everything, as we'll likely be in for a long haul afterwards, without further physical contact with any Polity worlds." She nodded thoughtfully.
"The Jerusalem?
It's there at Elysium, grabbing anything Jane-related. I'll explain later." He turned to Thorn, who also, he thought, looked unwell. "Thorn, no fuck-ups during transit, as I'll bet that any breach of the precautions will result in atomic sterilization." Thorn nodded. "Flint, is there any restriction on Trooper Gant?"
"None that I am aware of. Like yourself, he has been scanned and found to contain nothing anomalous."
"Okay. Gant, you come with me." Cormac stepped to one side and waved the others ahead of him. Gant moved to his side and watched them go. Mika glanced round, still looking thoughtful, then stepped up onto the dais and approached the shimmer of the Skyden warp contained between the bull's horns of the Runcible. She stepped through it and was gone.
Thorn then guided the grav sled ahead of him, causing it to rise higher and positioning it centrally to the warp. Before sending it through, he gave Gant a meaningful look.
I'll get Mika to memplant me on the Jack Ketch, but I don't suppose we'll be celebrating in Elysium, he said.
If she thinks it advisable, Gant replied woodenly. But it might be better to wait until your mycelium is removed.
Thorn nodded, and himself stepped through.
After a pause, Cormac asked the runcible AI, Are you reset?
Destination Viridian, now open, it replied.
Stepping onto the dais, Cormac asked Gant, What was all that about?
They approached the shimmering wall of energy, its light playfully batting their shadows about behind them.
Feeling his mortality, Gant replied.
That's a first.
Cormac stepped through.
The ash was 500 meters thick in places, accumulated on this volcanically active planet's single small tectonic plate, which slid around its surface like an ancient stone ship. There were no artifacts preserved in the ash, nor in the underlying stone. Rather, the artifact was the cause of both, requiring nothing to preserve it even here. Having resilience greater than any other material on the planet, it had neither melted nor broken, and the stone had accreted around it, and the ash built up on top of it over the eons. Cento considered how, for many years, researchers had come to study what they considered a natural phenomenon. A large layer of thermocrystal carbon within this small tectonic plate. Only recently had a scientist noted that the dense structure of this substance, which was similar to diamond, also bore a molecular resemblance to memory crystal. The woman, Shaden, then tried an optic interface and was astounded by the reams of code feeding back. Some of it looked like genetic data, but most of it was scrambled and as yet indecipherable. Polity AIs were now studying the download from the fragment of crystal Shaden had used in the hope of determining whether it was memory storage of the Jane, or perhaps of some other ancient race. Cento was here for the more prosaic purpose of ensuring that Shaden, who now waited back at her ship with her research assistant Horn, had not falsified her results.
We should see the layer further down, said Ulris.
Cento turned away from peering over the edge of the plate and glanced to where Ulris indicated. The dip further down would indeed bring them closer to the layer of thermocrystal carbon, just as it would bring them closer to the river of magma boiling through the crevasse beside them.
Then let's hurry,
he said, checking the timepiece set in the wrist of his suit, not because he needed to check the time, but because he wanted Ulris to remain aware of how little of it they had left.
We should get some outgassing before it blows.
Ulris gestured to the hellish plain beyond the river of molten rock, where a perfectly curved cliff, almost like a hydroelectric dam, occasionally became visible through the pall of smoke. This was just one edge of a massive caldera, which every 5 hours for the last 20 years had blown out a few million tons of rock, molten and solid, and ash, and a cornucopia of poison gases to contribute to the volatile and lethal atmosphere. We will be gone before then, whether I obtain a sample or not, Cento replied. They trudged on down the slope, eventually reaching the position indicated. Cento unshouldered his bolt gun and looked around. Noting an area clear of ash, he walked over, pressed the device down, and triggered it, firing a fixing bolt into stone. Discarding the bolt gun, he then unreeled, by its end ring, the monofilament line from the abseil motor on his belt. Stooping to click the ring into place on the bolt, he heard Ulrich begin yelling over comm. "What? No! Stop! No!" Sento stood and whirled to see the poor man suspended off the ground, held there by his biceps in the grip of a hugely tall humanoid who was walking him back to the crevasse edge. Sento reached down to detach the ring, but suddenly became aware of another humanoid. This one was standing beside him, clad head to foot in some sort of biotech suit. How he had not detected the approach of this one, Sento could only put down to the use of sophisticated chameleon wear. In less than a second he had assessed the situation. The likely source of the tech meant these two must be somehow connected with events on the planets Chain 3 and Masada, and therefore with how things would now proceed. Ignoring the smaller individual and leaving the ring attached, he accelerated towards the big one, who was now holding Ulrich out over the white-hot river. That the larger humanoid intended to drop the man, Sento had no doubt. The abseil motor screaming as it wound out monofilament, Sento leapt, just as the figure did drop Ulrich. He should have been able to grab him a couple of meters down from the edge. Before he even went over, a big hand slammed into his chest and stopped him dead. The big humanoid. Golem, to move that fast.
"Oh, God! No! No!"
Sento stabbed his hand towards the big golem's chest, just as he heard Ulrich's gasp of shock as he hit the magma. There would still be time. The man's hot suit would take a minute to give out. But the second hand clamped around Sento's wrist. The big golem pulled and turned, easily spinning Sento over and slamming him down on his back. The monofilament was now caught up under Sento's armpit and biting through his suit. Sento tried to turn as the other golem wrenched him to his feet and the filament cut deeper. He felt the arm disconnect, sheared clean away at the shoulder, then a backhanded blow deposited him at the edge.
"Oh, no! Oh, fuck, no!"
Sento rolled over in time to see Ulrich fighting to stay on the surface of the magma, his suit splitting and beginning to belch flame. His final scream truncated as his suit blew away and he burned incandescently. Something black and skeletal skittered like a spider on a hot plate. Briefly a cloud of black, oily smoke occluded the view, and when it cleared, only the silvery remains of the man's hot suit floated on the magma.
"Not fast enough, Sento."
It was the one in the biotech suit who spoke. Sento rolled as he came upright, so the monofilament was no longer twined around his chest. Perhaps he could pull it across the big golem's legs. He glanced at the speaker.
"Who are you? And what do you want here?" "Your arm."
The man pointed to the severed limb.
"Why should you want my arm?"
said Sento, as he moved sideways, dragging the filament across with him.
"Because it's his."
"His?" Sento gazed back at the big golem, noting that his arms were not evenly matched. His own severed arm, lying on the ground still wearing the sleeve of his suit, was a brass-coated metal-skin limb, both a replacement and a trophy from a battle fought years ago on a planet called Viridian.
"Mr. Crane?"
How could this be Mr. Crane? Sento clearly remembered their fight. Crane nearly destroyed him once, and it had needed both himself and his companion golem, Aiden, to finish the monster. They tore him apart, destroyed his crystal matrix mind. Yet now the same golem was back,
and it seemed much stronger and faster than before. That made no sense. Abruptly, Cento leapt to one side, intending to pull the monofilament across Crane's legs. But the big golem leapt nimbly and accelerated. Cento braced himself, but Crane outweighed him 3-1 and easily knocked him back over the edge. Scrabbling for grip with his remaining three limbs, Cento slid down a slope angled 30 degrees to the vertical. Stone just broke away from his grasp, but when the abseil motor started whining, he managed to reach down and initiate its brake. The line jerked him to a halt, only a meter above the magma.
That was close.
Cento looked up and saw both of them gazing down at him.
I wonder what happens if I do this.
Cento fell, hit the slope and slid further down, jamming his hand deep into a crevice to halt that slide. Monofilament fell about him like spindrift. With the spectrum of sensors he possessed, he did not need to look down to know that he was up to his thighs in magma. His hot suit gave out as quickly as Ulrich's, fire and smoke gusting around him as synth skin and the other combustible components of his legs burnt away. Now glancing down, he saw metallic traces mirroring the surface of the molten rock. When the magma flow finally pulled his lower legs away, it was something of a relief, as now it no longer threatened to drag him down. Glancing up again, he saw that this respite would not last. With slow but inexorable care, Mr. Crane was climbing down towards him. Cento did not highly rate his chances now against the huge golem. He glanced from side to side, hoping to see something, anything that might enable him to survive. To his right, just above where the crystal layer slanted down into the magma, was the open end of a lava tube, just under a meter wide. Maybe he could swing himself in there. Even though he was aware that these tubes usually extended no more than a few meters, bubbles of gas in the cooling magma, rather than a flow of it, having formed them, this seemed his only option. Perhaps, ensconced in such a place, he could even defend himself. On his remaining arm, he levered up his now reduced body weight. Glancing down, he saw that his legs had separated at the knee joint, and that only his bare hip bones protruded from the remains of his suit. The magma had melted the components in his knees, but not the cerimal of his bones. Looking up and seeing that Crane was now only a couple of meters above him, he began to swing himself from side to side to get up enough momentum. He released just as a boot slammed down towards his wrist. He hit the edge of the lava tube, groped inside it, his hip bones scrabbling away below him like a dwarf's legs. Then he was inside and turning himself around, the tube, as expected, being only a meter deep. Shortly, Mr. Crane's head appeared upside down in the tube mouth, peering in through the visor of his hot suit. Cento finally admitted to himself that he was dead. There was no escape. The big golem, with his full complement of limbs and obviously superior strength, would just reach inside and drag him out, probably to send him after Ulrich. Sure enough, the big hand now groped inside like a fat spider, slapped away Cento's defending hand and closed over his face. There came a long pause. Then the hand released him. What now? It wasn't possible to read the expression on that brass face. Mr. Crane suddenly reached down to the bottom of the lava tube, to the layer of crystal that formed its floor. He groped to the edge, where the crystal was jagged,
and snapped a piece off, which he brought up and held before his visor for inspection. He then closed his hand around it, holding out only one long forefinger, which he brought back to his visor. He placed it vertical to his mouth. "Shush now. Be quiet." Mr. Crane hauled himself out of view. While the metallier licked his lips and weighed yellow jade, Turgle studied the display of weapons in the cracked glass case and speculated on what Anderson's reaction might be to learning how he had obtained that precious stone. He realized the knight did not trust him, had been keeping a close eye on him, and well he might. Though the attraction of the knight was that he was everything Turgle wanted to be, as soon as that attraction waned, Turgle would rob him and move on. It was what he did. He was scum. Turgle had not told Anderson the entire truth. The mineralier frowned, had been a hard man, yet an honourable one. And Turgle's mother, after birthing the bastard Turgle so young, had been considered spoiled goods, so Frown's offer for her had been more than generous. He had paid for her in the Yellow Jade, of which only he knew the location. In the months that followed, Turgle's mother, though not loving the man, had come to respect him, and Turgle knew would come eventually to that other state too. Turgle now understood that his dislike of Frown had been rooted in jealousy, in having to share the mother who had once been all his own, and that his subsequent behaviour had been contemptible. Frown's attempts at gaining the boy's friendship had only increased his dislike. Those attempts had included the free use of Stone, one of Frown's three sandhogs, a generosity in money and clothing, and, finally, sharing the knowledge of the location of the precious jade. In his jealousy, Turgle had only construed that the man had been trying to buy him. Now he recognized Frown's bewilderment at such a reaction. The man had been according Turgle equal status, when he might so easily have rejected him. He had only been trying to act like a good father. Turgle sighed. Too late now to put things right. He truly regretted stealing both jade and hog, yet not his departure. In the years that had passed since, thieving or exchanging some of the jade or even working his way across many lands, he had experienced much more than would a parochial mineralier. And now was actually travelling with a rondure knight, the kind of man he had once thought only the inflated province of history and myth.
"Getting more frequent now," the metallier said.
Turgle turned to him.
"What?" "The quakes. Getting one just about every 20 days.
Turgle nodded, then looked pointedly at the jade. He wasn't going to get carelessly chatty with someone who was undoubtedly preparing to sting him.
"I can give you 1,000 pfennigs, said the mineralier eventually, as he began racking his weights.
Turgle turned from the case.
"There's 17 standard ounces of jade there, and the usual market price is between 80 and 100 pfennigs an ounce. At the lowest rate, that's 1,360.
The mineralier shrugged.
"You would deny me any profit at all?"
"I would deny no man profit, only limit the extent of it."
Turgle stabbed a finger down at the glass case.
1,100, and this, and we have a deal."
The mineralier came out from behind his counter and walked over to stand beside Turgle. He peered down at the weapon indicated.
"That is worth 250 alone, and you will require ammunition. I can let you have 2 spare clips, 100 rounds,
and 900 fennigs.
You'll wait until jade is 100 fennigs an ounce,
Turgle observed. The man shook his head.
There you are wrong. Observe the grip. I obtain these from Central Manufacturing, then make such fine additions. I would use the jade for the same.
The lapis lazuli grip had been what had first attracted Turgle's attention. He might find a better deal elsewhere, but not this particular handgun.
Make that 150 rounds, and you have your deal.
Very well, said the mineralier, reaching into his pocket to take out a roll of money. Quickly, he counted out the notes and handed them over. Turgle counted them again and slipped them into his own pocket, noting just how small a proportion they were of the man's entire roll. From under the case, the metallier removed three heavy paper boxes of ammunition, which he placed on a table nearby. From the case, he removed the gun itself and two clips. He handed them to Turgle.
Are you with the knight?
He asked.
I am.
The man reached over to where some leather items hung in a jumble behind the display case. Sorting through, he eventually found a plain belt and holster.
How much?
Turgle asked.
Gratis, said the man. If you're with him,
he gestured to the sunlit street.
You'll need to get to your weapon fast when he takes on his next commission.
You think? Turgle was confused. The roll of money had certainly attracted his attention, and now this unexpected generosity had diffused his growing speculation about how he might get his hands on the rest of that roll.
Oh, yes. Not much call for them round here now, with most people carrying weapons like this.
The man slapped a hand against the weapon holstered at his own hip, perhaps reading some of Turgle's intention.
But elsewhere, the work of a knight usually involves slayers and apex, when it doesn't concern the bounties set on human killers and thieves.
Over the last few days, Turgle had not even stopped to consider that. To him, Anderson had been just a figure out of a story, and what with coming into Golgoth and the talk of dragons, that feeling had only increased. But of course, Anderson must have some way of putting the fennigs into his pocket, and probably he was well used to dealing with scum. It now occurred to Turgle that he would not be telling the knight the full story of his own past, that perhaps he did not even need to.
Thank you.
Turgle took his acquisitions out into the sunshine. Chapter 6. Usually initiated by some technological innovation, the colonization of the human polity has run in successive waves, with intervals of 50 to 100 years between them. The first of these innovations was the invention of a very powerful ion drive, which resulted in the colonization of the solar system as far out as Jupiter. The efficient fusion drives coming into use after this resulted in establishing the further-flung colonies in the solar system and a wave of generation ships making the first leap to the stars. Some of these slow-moving behemoths are still in transit. The advent of Skyden's interfacing with the Krayestein computer created a completely new technology, from which, long before the first Runcible was built, resulted the first U-space drives. This was a chaotic period in the solar system. Governments and corporations competing for power and seemingly unaware that the tools they were using, the AIs, were becoming more powerful than them. It's not known how many colony ships, both the generation kind and ones utilizing U-space engines, escaped while AI
fought its quiet war for dominion. We are still finding colonies established during this time, and many speculate that there may be hundreds more yet to locate. From Quince Guide, compiled by humans. Once the ground tremors eased, Cento pushed his head and upper body out of the lava bubble and fruitlessly tried to use his internal radio to contact the survey ship. But there was just too much stone sitting between him and where that vessel rested up on the ridge. Further attempts to contact the orbiting carrier shell also produced no result, but then that could now be on the other side of the planet. He estimated that only 12 meters above he would be able to obtain a sufficient direct line to the landed vessel. But even then he wondered. The layer of crystal below him seemed to be doing things to the signal that defied analysis. When he first felt the groping for contact, he dismissed it as part of this same effect. When the attempt at making a connection became more insistent, he considered shutting down his radio, fearing that this might be another attack upon him. But Mr. Crane had let him live, taking a piece of crystal rather than Cento's artificial life. So, as far as the other humanoid was concerned, Cento was long gone in the river of magma. He tuned to the groping signal and made contact. "Who are you?" he asked over the link.
"Vulture. Ship. Skellor,"
came the reply, along with corrupted code and a weird whining note like a child crying. Cento absorbed that last name and immediately knew who the second humanoid was. Cento had taken much interest in the events on Masada, and with his ECS clearance, he had obtained the full story. That a copy of himself had died aboard the Occam Razor had greatly focused his interest. So, somehow, Skellor had escaped, still possessing Jane technology. This also explained Crane's resurrection and superior strength and speed. Skellor had obviously made him something more than a merely boosted Golem 25. "Skellor's ship?" he asked.
"Salvor burned now. Take download. Going U-space. It coming."
"I'm prepared for the download, but any attempt at subversion and..." The download came anyway. Jumbled information, hints of exchanges of information, views of Skellor standing behind a pilot's chair containing the burnt-out husk of a human being, Mr. Crane squatting on the floor with objects arranged in front of him like chessmen. Then, in one brief burst before the signal cut off, coordinates. Cento knew that information like this was critical, for with the sheer size of the polity and all the methods of transportation available, ECS might never find Skellor. But how to convey those coordinates to somewhere they might be of use? The golem surveyed his surroundings and ran diagnostics on himself. Quite apart from the fact that he only had one arm and was trapped in a rock bubble at the bottom of a steep slope, the heat from the nearby river of magma was beginning to affect some of his systems. Already memory storage was becoming dubious as the crystal matrix of his mind distorted. The motors in his hips had ceased to function, and those in his remaining arm were into amber. His sight was also going. Infrared was unusable in this situation, but he was also losing the other end of the spectrum. His internal radar suffered the same distortions from the crystal lying below as did his radio. Apart from those latter badly distorted two, he in fact only possessed now the senses of a human being. He had to try for the survey ship again, and to do that he had to get himself higher. Sento reached above him and was thankful that what remained of his hot suit had preserved the synth flesh underneath. This at least meant that he retained a sense of touch. Groping about, he found a crevice, which he tested by wrenching hard against its sides to make sure the rock would not break away. He shut off that part of his emulation program that prevented his joints moving more than was humanly possible. Planning every move in advance, he reached higher, jammed his hand in, then, using the full swing of his shoulder joint, hauled himself out of the bubble like a winkle from its shell. For a second, he was suspended over magma. Then, using his wrist joint and elbow, he pulled himself up to the point where he could lodge the knee end of his right thigh bone in the lower part of the crevice, and then lay his torso flat against the slope. This he did just in time as another tremor tumbled loose stone down all about him. He kept his head down until the cascade had ceased, then looked up. Now he could see that the crevice ran at an angle up the slope and would take him about 5 meters higher. The problem was that each time he released his hand, he would be supported only by his hip bone and by his weight pressing against the loose stone of the slope. But there was no choice. This close to the magma, the heat would destroy him eventually. He turned and withdrew his hand, reached higher and jammed it in, and maggot-like hauled himself up and up, pausing every time the ground shook, clinging as tightly as he could while falling stone threatened to dislodge him. 5 meters. Here, Sento noted that some of his systems were coming back online, that the numerous warnings he had been receiving were growing fewer. Glancing down, he saw that a curve in the slope now concealed him from the incandescence below, and checking his internal temperature, he saw it was dropping. Abruptly, the motors in his hip joints came back on. Here, he realized, he might be able to survive for as long as his power supply held out, and even then his mind might remain intact afterwards. Perhaps he should secure himself as best he could and just drop to minimal function. Sento considered this for only a moment before removing his hand from the crevice and reaching above to clear away loose rock in search of a fresh handhold. Sento was ECS, and though as a free golem he could choose between duty and survival, he chose duty. Eventually, he located a jut of stone that seemed sufficient to support him, clamped his hand on it, and hauled himself up once again. But he could not get himself high enough to lodge his thigh bone against that same stone. Lowering himself again, he cleared more rock and found a small hollow just below and to one side of the outcrop. He pulled himself up again, lodging the bone's end in this hollow, easier now that he could actually move his thigh bones about, and from this precarious position groped higher. Stone skidded as he pushed it aside, banging and clattering past him. Smooth intestinal stone above now, nothing to grip. Another sudden ground tremor bounced his leg bone out of the hollow. He flailed for a grip as he began to fall, his hand sliding over this treacherously smooth stone. Then, before him there appeared a crack, leaking sulphurous gas under pressure. Then his arm went through in an explosion of such gas, and he found a safe grip inside another lava bubble. Sento would have breathed a sigh of relief
if he had not turned off his lungs while in the previous bubble. After using his head to break away more of the thin crust, he peered inside and saw that this cavity formed the terminus of a lava tube extending up the slope. Pulling himself inside, he began to inch his way up the smooth interior, using thigh bones, head, and arm as four limbs. Here he took more risks, as a fall now would only result in him ending up back at the bottom of the tube, not trying to swim in molten rock, and consequently he traversed its 20-metre curving length in a matter of minutes. Now all he had to do was get out of there. Wedged on his back, braced by head and thigh bones, Sento drove his fist outwards at what he estimated to be an angle of 90 degrees to the slope itself. Stone shattered under this pile-driver blow and fell in on him to reveal a bruised sky into which poured black smoke and fountains of magma. Of course, the eruption about which they had been warned. Early. That figured. Skellor stepped back and inspected his handiwork. Mr. Crane raised his replacement arm and closed his hand into a fist. Fastidiously, he then reached out and took up first his hat, then his coat, from where he had draped them over a nearby console. Placing the hat on his head, he tilted it to the required angle, before donning his coat and with slow precision fastening each button. Why, when given limited freedom to act, the Golem had spent much of the voyage hither using equipment and materials found aboard this ship to fashion such clothing, Skellor could not fathom. But it was part of the weird fascination Mr. Crane held for him.
"Quite the dandy, aren't you?"
muttered Skellor, discarding the arm replaced down beside Salvar's corpse, both now just organic detritus. Now Skellor smirked as he watched Crane step back, squat down on the floor and pull out his various toys. Joining the rubber dog, the acorns from Blue Oaks on Viridian, 5 cubes of survival rations, and various other items gathered from inside this same ship, was now a piece of green crystal. Briefly linking inside the Golem, Skellor observed that the crystal and the dog had found their places in the Matrix, which drastically increased Crane's chances of putting the rest together in the right order. However, though the odds against him achieving the right combination before had been 3.6 × 10^14 to 1, they weren't that much better now. Probing inside Crane to see how he had managed to achieve even this reduction of odds, he encountered a resistance that was integral to Crane's entire mind. Skellor could easily have broken it, but in doing so, he would lose that essential, fascinating Mr. Crane. He turned away, stepped over the human remains on the floor, and seated himself in the pilot's chair. If Crane ever managed to reduce the odds to, say, the chances of a meteorite striking him on the head, Skellor would take action. But now, to the task in hand. There were 2 areas of space, 2 possible destinations, one inside the polity and one beyond its border. This much he had learnt from the Reverend Ephiriath Loman Dorth before killing the man. The network of DracoCorp orgs that had been coming under the man's control at Masada had initially seemed a complete entity. Further probing its structure, Skellor had ascertained it to be a slave cell, that, upon reaching maturity, that point
where Dorth gained absolute control over the other minds in the network, would link via other networks to an autocratic control. There were two such centres of control, with only vague locations, the two dragon spheres. Skellor had, of course, already chosen the one outside polity space. Even so, that particular area extended 100 light years across, so locating dragon inside it would be no easy task. Skellor considered how he might achieve his ends. Previously, the most likely way of locating dragon had seemed to be to find a DracoCorp facility and work from there. But his probes into the AI and virtual networks from Viridian had quickly disabused him of this notion. Dragon had foreseen that enemies would follow this trail, and so, rather than erase it, had concealed it under 1,000 false trails. Gaining information concerning even these had also quickly turned into a risky option when his searching attracted the attention of some seriously dangerous hunter-killer AI programs engaged on the same search. Obviously, ECS also seriously wanted to know Dragon's location. No, he must use a different approach. Tracing Dragon through the orgs those facilities manufactured and which were now in use. The running of DracoCorp was not something Dragon had to remain wholly engaged in, but slow accretion of control through the networks thereby generated required it. To find the link from this distance, Skellor needed to infiltrate network after network to follow it home. Better then, to find such a network much nearer to that same home, nearer to Dragon. So thinking, Skellor affirmed the coordinates already input and dropped the vulture into underspace. Retroact 7. Alston supposed various factors were interacting in the man's mind. Obviously, the longer the interrogation, the longer he would stay alive. However, the longer he delayed answering questions, the greater would be his agony. Alston was therefore beholden to increase the man's agony to that point where, in the hope of a quick death, he would become more forthcoming. Alston always loved the way his victims reacted when, having obtained what he wanted, Alston continued with the torture. There was horror and a kind of indignation at this betrayal of the unspoken contract between torturer and tortured. "I've been aware for some time that Arion wants me dead. That is hardly news to me, but I want details. When does he plan to launch an attack on my island? How many of his people will he send? What kind of armaments will they be carrying?" Semper, suspended upside down from the boom at the back of the fishing barge, bubbled something. Alston wondered who had first worked out that suspending someone by their feet increased the blood pressure in their head and thus prevented them from fainting. He again reached out with the wire cutters to where Semper's hands had been nailed to the stern rail, and with one crunching snip sent a little finger bouncing across the deck. "What was that?" When he had stopped yelling, Semper articulated more carefully. "Not sending his men!"
Alston passed the wire cutters over to Chaldor, the woman who had been so proficient with the nails and who had earlier burnt out Semper's right eye with a red-hot kitchen fork.
"What do you mean, not sending his men? You told me earlier that an attack is planned."
Gazing at Alston with his remaining eye, Semper managed,
"Today? Maybe tomorrow."
Alston peeled the surgical glove from his right hand, then reached up and turned on the comm unit attached to his collar.
"Evans, take us back in."
Immediately the boat's engine droned, and below Semper the water boiled as the craft began to come about. Alston glanced at the box of gloves open on the table nearby, then peeled off the other glove and went over to get a fresh pair.
"What do you think?" he asked Chaldor.
Chaldor, as attractive as she was mean, with her red hair plaited intricately against her head and containing as much concealed weaponry as it did jewellery, gazed at him with her pure purple eyes.
"I think he has a lot more to tell us. What's this machine he was babbling about?"
"Yes, I think you're right." Alston took the wire cutters from Chaldor and once again turned to his victim.
"Now, Semper, please tell us about this machine of Arian's."
"It's a golem! A golem!"
From Semper there then issued a piggish squealing. Alston counted fingers and saw that he had enough left for 5 further questions.
"Golem don't work for separatists. It seems to me that your loyalty to Arian is much stronger than I thought. Still, you are trying to cover for him. Still, you have not answered my questions. I want to know how many men, what weaponry, and when."
"It's a golem. Broken golem. Brought in from Huma."
Alston sighed and shook his head. "Chaldor, go and get the blowtorch and the sanding machine. It seems we'll have to go all the way." As the afternoon progressed, and as they came back in sight of the island, Alston was surprised at Semper's resistance, always coming back to the same ridiculous story about a broken golem. Near the end, Alston was tempted to believe that story, but he knew that broken golem were as mythical as Horace Blegg, and were such a creature possible, an AI hater like Arian Pelter would never use it. Dumping what was left of Semper over the side, as food for the adapted whitebait and pearl crabs swarming in the shallows around the island, he finally admitted defeat. Semper had managed to conceal the truth unto death. Retroact ends. Gant seemed on edge, studying the throng as if he expected attack from every direction. Cormac supposed the uploaded soldier had every right to be paranoid while accompanying him. Bad things tended to happen around Cormac.
"Why am I able to gridlink?"
Cormac asked, as he strode on ahead of Gant across the embarkation lounge.
"A rather deeper scan than I am managing now would be required to answer that question,"
Viridian replied directly into his link.
"It seems that somehow you have managed, at an unconscious level, to turn your gridlink back on. Only an AI such as myself should be able to do this, though there is one human who possesses the ability to interfere with AI coding at that level."
"Let me guess. Horace Blegg?"
"Correct."
What about memories of U-space? Quint's transportation is instantaneous. So how do you explain that?
What memories?
I can't vocalize it. Cormac opened the bandwidth of his link and sent the jumbled images that plagued him. He sensed the AI receiving and studying those images. And just to test, he applied to it on another level for information concerning his visit here.
Major Arn is awaiting you at the exit, a submind replied.
Cormac scanned ahead and saw that same individual in the uniform of the ES regulars standing beside shimmer shield doors leading outside. The man looked ill at ease. Cormac glanced at Gant, caught his gaze, and with a nod drew his attention over to Arn.
I don't suppose he's too glad to see you, said Gant. You got a lot of his men dead.
Cormac nodded, continuing the silent conversation in his head, as he and Gant headed towards the waiting man. What do you think?
The images are... I see you accessed one of my sub-minds. It would seem your grid link is regaining total function. As I was saying, these images are the nearest human interpretation of U-space possible. You have definitely seen it, yet hopefully you are still sane. This is unusual.
Let me guess again. Only one other?
Correct.
As they approached Arn, Cormac accessed information on the man. He'd been a sergeant when Cormac had first known him, and his performance against Arian Pelter had resulted in his promotion by Viridian, who was, like all Runcible AIs, also the planetary governor. Good to see you again, said Cormac, holding out his hand. Arn gripped the hand, but did not return the compliment.
I've got a strato car outside which should get us there in a few hours, he said. I also received a message that you have further requirements.
Ground scanning gear and maybe an excavator later on, Cormac replied. Arn nodded, and Cormac picked up the hint of a transmission from the grey military org behind the man's right ear. Cormac realized that he himself now possessed the ability to make all the required arrangements. However, he was not yet prepared to rely on his gridlink. Arn now turned to Gant and studied him.
Gant,
said the uploaded soldier, holding out his hand. I partnered Thorn in our Sparkind unit.
You weren't here back then,
Arn observed, shaking the hand.
I had a bit of a problem.
Problem?
I was dead.
This did not seem